This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel, Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of 2 Corinthians. Open your Bibles and let's join Pastor Sandy in the book of 2 Corinthians, chapters 12 and 13.
See, this is what makes me suspicious of pompous preachers today who claim similar experiences. Hey, if Paul stayed silent for 14 years, if he felt that his feeble human expressions could never do heaven justice, who are the people today who want to flaunt their visions and their revelations? Who do they think they are? When you really see the glory of God, you're hushed. You become speechless. God just takes your breath away. That's what God does. Reminds me of the 85-year-old couple. They'd been married for 60 years. They'd been in good health, mainly due to her interest in health food and exercise. When they reached heaven, Peter took them to their luxurious mansion. And as they oohed and aahed, the old man, he asked Peter, he says, "Wow, how much is this going to cost?" "It's free," Peter replied. "This is heaven." Well, in addition, their home backed up to this championship golf course. And each day, the course actually changed to some new golf course resembling one of the famous courses here on earth. The old man asked, "Wow, what are the green fees?" Again, Peter replied, "This is heaven, man. You play for free." Well, next they went up to the clubhouse and they saw this lavish buffet. "Wow, how much to eat?" asked the old man. Peter was growing impatient. He said, "Man, you don't get it yet. It's heaven, man. It's free." Well, it was starting to seep in a little bit. The old man asked him, he says, "Well, where's the low fat and the low cholesterol tables?" Finally, Peter lectured him. He said, "That's the best part, man. You can eat as much as you like of whatever you like, and you never get fat, you never get sick. Man, this is heaven." Well, that was it, man. He just went into a rage. He got angry with his wife. After Peter finally calmed him down, he asked him what was wrong. That's when the old man, he turned to his wife of 60 years and he says, "This is all your fault. If it weren't for your blasted bran muffins, I'd have been up here 10 years ago." Well, when we arrive in heaven, when we arrive in heaven, we won't long for anything that we've left behind on earth. Heaven will be heavenly. We may never get as vivid a picture of heaven as Paul, but God has revealed to us our future glory in His Word. That means that we know, before we begin our ministry, we know how it's going to end. We've seen the vision. You know, it's hard to endure the rigors of serving God here on earth without a clear view of its rewards. Always keep your eyes on heaven, and you can endure anything this world might dish out. Well, Paul continues in verse 5. "Of such a one I will boast, yet of myself I will not boast except in my infirmities." Paul, in his humility, was far more comfortable discussing the low points when he had to cry out to God for help than he was the high points when God spoke to him. He says, "For though I might desire to boast, I will not be a fool, for I will speak the truth. But I refrain lest anyone should think of me above what he sees me to be or hears from me." Paul was very leery of inflating his pride. He would have never gone down this path of boasting had the Corinthians not doubted his ministry, had he not felt that he needed to somehow substantiate and legitimize his calling. Well, you know, God also knew of Paul's human tendency to become proud and puffed up. And this is why God went to efforts to guard against that pride. Verse 7, Paul says, "And lest I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of the revelations, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I be exalted above measure." Wow, you get to see heaven. You have a vision of heaven. That's a pretty heavy revy, if you ask me. And you tend to lose your feet on, you get your head in the clouds when you see something like that. Well, God was quick to bring Paul back to earth. He gave him a thorn in the flesh to humble him, to buffet him, to keep his feet on the ground, to remind him of his humanity. Notice Paul doesn't exactly identify it He just calls it his thorn in the flesh. And I think that's deliberate. For God gives us all certain things to humble us and to keep us trusting in him and keep us looking to him. If he'd identified his thorn as one particular thing, then if we didn't have that, we wouldn't think we had a thorn. But we all have our thorn in the flesh that God gives us to humble us and keep us humble. Of course, all kinds of theories have been advanced about Paul's thorn. For me, the most plausible idea was that it was an infectious eye disease that flared up from time to time, especially when he moved into the warmer, more humid tropical climates. It could be that the blinding light on the road to Damascus that he saw at the beginning of his ministry, at his conversion, actually weakened his eyes, and somehow he picked up an infection which caused his eyes to scab over from time to time. You know, in Galatians chapter 4, verse 15, we find some evidence of this. Paul is speaking of the Galatians' compassion toward him. He says, "You would have plucked out your own eyes and given them to me if you could have." It's possible that Paul was having trouble with his eyes while he was there in Galatia. In Galatians 6, verse 11, he talks about the large letters or the large script in which he had written his letter. Again, possibly another indication that he was having a problem with his vision at the time, that he wrote in these big looping letters. You know, the Greek word translated thorn, it means a stake or a dagger. Literally, like somebody's poking something into your eye. A person suffering from trachoma develops a pus over the eye that causes the lashes to become brittle and at times even digs into the eyeball. You know, if you've ever had a scratch on your cornea, you can imagine the pain that such an ordeal puts you through. It feels like a knife or a thorn just thrust into your eye. All we know for sure about Paul's thorn is that it didn't go away. He writes in verse 8, "Concerning this thing, I pleaded with the Lord 3 times that it might depart from me." He prayed 3 times, and yet the Lord's answer each time was, "No, this is something you're going to have to live with." It was his thorn in the flesh. Remember, Jesus prayed 3 times for the cup to pass from him in the Garden of Gethsemane. Perhaps Paul was modeling Jesus' prayer. He prayed 3 times. But instead of taking away the thorn, the Lord said to him, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness." With a blessing comes a tendency towards pride. And to safeguard against it, God will often plant a thorn in our life to keep us humble. It's a reminder of how desperately we need God. It's painful, but that reminder is worth it. You see, the thorn is what keeps driving us to our knees. Even though Paul prayed 3 times, God refused to remove the thorn. A weakened Paul learned that the greatest strength is not found in oneself, but in God's sufficiency. May we learn that same lesson. Paul's thorn made him depend on God's all-sufficient grace in a way that he would have never experienced without it. Roy Campanella was an all-star catcher for the Brooklyn Dodgers. Before he lost the use of his arms and legs in an automobile accident. But Roy, he had an amazing attitude. He saw his handicap as more a blessing than a blight. Roy once commented, "We're a rugged breed, us quads. If we weren't, we wouldn't be around today. In many ways, we've been blessed with a savvy and a spirit that isn't given to everybody." An interesting experience helped to form Campanella's attitude. For months, he did his physical therapy at a hospital there on the East River in New York. And countless times, he rolled his wheelchair past a plaque hanging on the wall. One day, he stopped to read it. Then he reread it. And then he kept rereading it. Here's what was engraved on the plaque. "I asked God for strength that I might achieve. I was made weak that I might learn humbly to obey. I asked for health that I might do great things. I was given infirmity that I might do better things. I asked for riches that I might be happy. I was given poverty that I might be wise. I asked for power that I might have the praise of men. I was given weakness that I might feel the need for God. I asked for all things that I might enjoy life. I was given life that I might enjoy all things. I got nothing I asked for, but everything I had hoped for. I am among men most richly blessed. This was Roy Campanella's attitude, and this was the attitude of the Apostle Paul. Rather than grow mad at God for not removing his thorn, he viewed it as a gift from God. He rejoiced in his weakness, knowing that it was an opportunity for God to demonstrate his supernatural strength in Paul's life. Well, Paul finishes his thoughts on the thorn in verse 9. Therefore, most gladly, I will rather boast in my infirmities that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. He was strong in Christ's strength. We always stand stronger while leaning on the Lord than we do standing tall in our own pride and in our own strength. Verse 11, I have become a fool in boasting. You have compelled me. For I ought to have been commended by you. For in nothing was I behind the most eminent apostles, though I am nothing. You see, the Corinthians, they should have appreciated Paul. Instead, they had forced him to boast and extol his own merits. The foolish Corinthians were proud of the wrong teachers. They had exalted the phony men of God. They called them the eminent apostles. You remember what that literally means? It means super apostles. They had called themselves the super apostles. But in no way were they superior to Paul. Though Paul saw himself as a nobody, God had made him a somebody. Verse 12, truly the signs of an apostle were accomplished among you with all perseverance in signs and wonders and mighty deeds. I mean, Paul, while in Corinth, Paul had proven his apostleship. He had worked miracles, miracles being one of the signs of an apostle. The Corinthians had seen God himself confirm Paul's apostleship through the miracles that he had worked among them. For what is it in which you were inferior to other churches, except that I myself was not burdensome to you? Forgive me this wrong. There, Paul's pen drips with sarcasm. The only thing these super apostles did that Paul didn't was to try to take the Corinthians' money from them. Paul is saying, forgive me for not ripping you off like those other guys. See, he had taken financial support from other churches so that he could minister freely to the Corinthians. He didn't want pleas for money to cast a cloud over his motives. Verse 14, now for the third time, I am ready to come to you, and I will not be burdensome to you, but I do not seek yours, but you. Paul is coming again to Corinth, and he's not after their money. He only wants their hearts. He wants to win them to Jesus. You know, there are two approaches to ministry. Some pastors feel that the congregation exists for them. They'd never say it. They'd never admit it. But in a thousand subtle ways, this is what gets communicated. The church is there to build the pastor's dreams, to build up his empire. But there are pastors who serve the congregation. They exist for the people, not vice versa. They're there to give and serve and love and teach and help. And this was Paul's attitude. He had a servant's heart. He writes, for the children ought not to lay up for the parents, but the parents for the children. Oh boy, isn't this true? I mean, as a father, I'm the one who scrapes and saves and sacrifices for my kids. Believe me, my kids didn't do a lot of scraping and saving for me while they were growing up. One day, though, my kids will do that for their kids. Why? Because parents are the ones who lay up and pay up for their kids, not the kids for the parents. Which reminds me of the four kids who decided to chip in and buy Dad a nice Father's Day present. One of the kids suggested, hey, let's get Dad a gift that we can all get something out of. They decided to buy him a wallet. You know, the best definition I've heard of a dad, a man who now carries pictures where he once carried his money. And you see, he's saying that a true pastor will have the heart of a father. that he'll want to lay up for the people, that he'll want to serve and give to the people, not vice versa. Paul is saying that if you want to serve for what you can get out of it, that's insincere. You need to want to give, and you need to want to serve, and you need to want to help other people. Christian service is equal to spiritual parenthood. You get involved in ministry because you're willing to spend your life to see others grow and others mature and others prosper. You don't do it so that you can get something out of it. This is why Paul continues, "And I will very gladly spend and be spent for your souls." Isn't that amazing? Paul was willing to waste his life away on the Corinthians. "I'm willing to spend and be spent in order to see you grow in your relationship with Jesus." He loved them so much that he would exhaust his resources and burn his energy and sacrifice his health to see the souls of the Corinthians flower and flourish. Again, this is the heart of a true pastor. And when you find a guy like this, I hope you support him and I hope you follow him. But that wasn't the Corinthians' attitude, sadly. Paul groans, "Though the more abundantly I love you, the less I am loved." How sad is that? He was pouring out his life for them, and yet the more he loved them, the less he was loved. The church at Corinth was taking Paul's sacrificial ministry and the selfless minister for granted. You know, it's a kid's tendency to take their parents for granted. And sadly, some churches have the same lax attitude toward their leaders. This was the problem in Corinth. Verse 16, "But be that as it may, I did not burden you. Nevertheless, being crafty, I caught you by cunning. Did I take advantage of you by any of those whom I sent to you?" And of course, he's asking a rhetorical question. The answer is an obvious no. Paul was above board. He wasn't trying to take advantage of anyone. He said, "I urged Titus and sent our brother with him. Did Titus take advantage of you? Did we not walk in the same spirit? Did we not walk in the same steps?" Not once did Paul or his pals try to manipulate or try to intimidate the Corinthians or to try to, you know, maneuver them in a way for their own benefit. Not once. He says, "Again, did you think that we excuse ourselves to you? We speak before God in Christ, but we do all things, beloved, for your edification." Paul's only motivation was to edify or to build up these Corinthians. Verse 20, "For I fear lest when I come, I shall not find you such as I wish, and that I shall be found by you such as you do not wish." Paul is afraid that his next visit to Corinth is going to turn ugly, that he'll find these believers in sin, these believers taking the things of God for granted, and he'll be forced to administer a sterner rebuke. He fears that what he'll find, he says, "lest there be contentions and jealousies and outbursts of wrath and selfish ambitions and backbitings and whisperings and conceits and tumults." He's got a bad feeling about these Corinthians. These are the things he's going to find when he gets there. Now here's an interesting exercise. Compare this list of fleshly behavior, carnal behavior, here in 2 Corinthians 12, with Paul's earlier description of God's love in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. I'm going to do it for you. Here's a comparison. Contentions. And yet what does Paul say about love? Love is kind. Jealousies. Love does not envy. Outbursts of wrath. Love does not behave rudely. Selfish ambitions, love does not seek its own. Backbitings, love is not provoked. Whisperings, love thinks no evil. Conceits, love is not puffed up. Here is tumults. There in 1 Corinthians 13, love suffers long. See, the problem was simple. These Corinthians, they lacked love. That's why all of these other things were going on in their congregation. He says, "Lest when I come again, my God will humble me among you, and I shall mourn for many who have sinned before and have not repented of their uncleanness, fornication, and lewdness which they have practiced. The Greek word Paul uses that's translated mourn describes mourning for the dead. Paul's saying, I don't want my next visit to be a wake for a dead church. I want to find some fellowship among you, not a funeral. Straighten these things out. Chapter 13. This will be the third time I am coming to you. And he's preparing now for this upcoming visit. By the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word shall be established. He quotes here Deuteronomy 19, verse 15. For under the law, you needed two or three eyewitnesses to convict a person of a crime. And Paul basically here, he's mounting his case against the Corinthians. He's heard of their rebellion. That's one witness. Now he's coming to see for himself. That would be two witnesses. He's saying, ready or not, here I come. And if he finds that in the mouth of two or three witnesses the same thing, he's going to bring judgment. He's going to deal with them face to face now and put an end to their lives and straighten these guys out with a stern rebuke. He's warning them. He says, I've told you before and foretell as if I were present the second time, and now being absent, I write to those who have sinned before and to all the rest that if I come again, I will not spare. Paul, are you threatening us? Absolutely, he's threatening you. He said, if I come and you haven't straightened these things out, I'm going to take you to task. The word translated spare means to spare in battle. Paul is declaring war on the false teachers that were stirring up trouble there in Corinth. He says, since you seek a proof of Christ speaking in me, who is not weak towards you but mighty in you, for though he was crucified in weakness, yet he lives by the power of God. For we also are weak in him, but we shall live with him by the power of God towards you. Paul was criticized for being weak in appearance, unpolished in speech, unpretentious in mannerisms. He wasn't as flamboyant as his critics. And the carnal Corinthians had mistaken gaudiness for godliness. Paul straightens them out here by pointing to Christ. He says, wait a minute. Jesus appeared weak. On the cross, he was the antithesis of what the world considers successful. Jesus wasn't pleasing to look at. Jesus wasn't pretty. Jesus shattered worldly criteria. He proved that physicality can never measure spirituality. And since appearances can be deceiving, Paul suggests that the Corinthians not only reevaluate him, but reevaluate themselves. He says in verse 5, he says, it's time you examined yourselves as to whether you're even in the faith. Test yourselves. Do you not know yourselves that Jesus Christ is in you, unless indeed you are disqualified? Now here's the truth. Just because you call yourself a Christian doesn't mean that you are one. Just because you attend church and wear a Christian t-shirt from time to time and you sprinkle your language with a little Christian lingo and listen to Christian music and quote Bible verses, that doesn't make you a Christian. Paul concedes that some of these Corinthians may have been pulling the wool over their own eyes. They've been fooling themselves. They need to examine themselves to see if they are in the faith. We all would do well to do the same thing. Mom overheard a little girl praying one night. Now I lay me down to rest. I pray I pass tomorrow's test. If I should die before I wake, that's one less test I'll have to take. The truth is that when we die, we receive our final grade. And it's a pass or fail, friends. Either you have embraced Jesus as Lord or you haven't. You've resisted him, or you've just never got around to taking him seriously, but both receive failing grades.
Being on the go is something we're all accustomed to in this culture. The hustle and bustle of life seems to make the days just fly by. For most of us, our smartphones are sort of an extension of our bodies. Constantly ringing and dinging, telling us where to be and what the next appointment is. The technology that we enjoy in this day and age is amazing. And while there's certainly no end to the bad things we can find online and through our smartphones, There's also some great kingdom-minded options. We'd like to invite you to download the Sandy Adams mobile app. Our mobile app is available for iPhone, Android, and Windows smartphones. Or log on to sandyadams.org and simply click on the link from the main menu. When you download the app, you'll be able to listen to the most recent messages taught by Pastor Sandy, browse the series archive, and search the archive alphabetically. Finally, when you download the mobile app, you'll also have the opportunity to join us live for our Sunday morning worship service right from your smartphone. Again, to download the Sandy Adams mobile app, simply enter Sandy Adams in the search options of your smartphone's app store, or log on to sandyadams.org and simply click on the mobile app option right on the homepage. And please join us again as Pastor Sandy continues teaching through the Bible right here on Sandy Adams Radio.